the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. We used to call these nooners, but we've since had a conscious decoupling. My name is Joey. I'm here with my co-host Len and the other panel. What's going on, buddy? How you doing?
I'm sitting here all unloved and all unwanted. I'm okay other than that, Joey. How are you? I see you're growing some facial hair.
I'm starting. Yeah. I haven't told my wife yet. She'll be home probably in half an hour. So I don't know what my plan is. I'm supposed to be able to start walking in a couple of days. So cast comes off tomorrow. Hopefully in a few days I can like walk with relative power. I was just doing a size check on my quads and hammies this morning. They look pretty good, all things considered. So happy about that. Anyway, we're talking to Crypto Mags today. She's not with us just yet, but I'm sure she'll be here shortly. In the meantime, let me tell you about our show sponsor, ShakePay, channel sponsor, sponsor. Incredible. Yeah. One of the best logos in the game. You can see two over here on this chair. one circa probably, yeah. I don't know. Those old hats are probably circa like 2019 maybe. And your hat there and the other one that I have is circa this year. So or last year, I guess. So, they've been a great sponsor for us. You can use our promo code CBP, Charlie Beta Peter, sign up, get an account. Easy as easy gets. And they'll throw you $30, I should say, on your first $100 Bitcoin buy, which is pretty solid, man. Not a better way to spend a hundo. And so you got that going on. And then on top of that, you can shake your phone every day and they'll stream you a few sats up to day, I think it's like day 200. And it's 1,000 a day after that, right?
That is it.
Rock solid.
Yeah.
And so you got that. And then finally, the Shaking Sats or the Sats Back Visa card, which is a way to spend your ShakePay CAD balance and earn a couple of Satoshis while you're buying, I don't know, hopefully something approved. That's all I'll say. with that, Meg was just in the green room. She dropped out. Maybe she'll be back in a second.
She had enough of us already. We didn't even have a chance to start.
I'm not sure what happened. She'll be back shortly. So she's the VP of business development for CoinKite, and she also works with Citadel 256, which is a hosting platform. So we're gonna bring her in. She needs no introduction. Great blue screen there. I thought it was a green screen type. Okay, nice. So Megs is here.
Sideways, upside down. I don't know what's going on. I'm getting disoriented here.
It's weird because I was trying to get it the right way. Hello, everyone. My headset for some reason StreamYard is not cooperating.
Oh, yeah.
We got to call those guys.
Do you have any tech support you could call on? Or like, it's got to be somebody. Get on the horn. Get this thing done. This is high quality, you know, podcasting here. We got to make sure.
It looks great, Megs. Everything looks good. Okay, so we're happy here.
I'm concerned about sound. Like, can you guys hear me or no?
Oh yeah,
loud and clear.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm not using any official headset type thing.
No problem at all. So
yeah, she's breaking new ground now. She doesn't even need the regular.
That's
stuff.
Right.
She's,
I know. There's already people cheering you on in the chat for your efforts here today. So we're happy to have you. Thank you for coming. We appreciate your time and efforts here. Tell people, for those who are unfamiliar with you, your work, and we're going to talk a little bit about your background today as well. So if you want to share that. What's going on? Who is Crypto Mags?
Sure. So I've been around the block on Bitcoin. So I think one of the first things I did in the space in Canada was launching the first Bitcoin fund. So publicly listed on a Toronto Stock Exchange. I work with 3IQ. We did the whole going around the banks trying to get it listed publicly in an IPO. It was a very interesting experience. So that's kind of like in the financialization area of Bitcoin. I like to kind of bucket Bitcoin into different parts. So that's bucket one and ETFs. I worked in mining for a while with co-founders of Hut 8 on Citadel 256, kind of like Hut 8 2.0, helping Chinese miners relocate. That was actually started before China cracked down. So it was an interesting experience there as well. Very timely. Sometimes you get lucky. Other times you're just too early or too late. I currently work with CoinKite. I'm VP of business development, and we make hardware wallets. Whole bunch of cool products made in Canada. And that's kind of, you know, the hardware wallet custody space, covering that off. And the one spot that I haven't yet spent time in is Lightning, maybe sometime in the future. But I think those are, you know, when it comes to Bitcoin, I like to see it kind of different sort of subsectors. But before Bitcoin,
BBTC.
Yeah. So I worked in Canada for the Ontario government. I worked on energy policy and economic development, largely kind of focusing on the low carbon transition. So, you know, climate change regs are coming, whether it's a carbon tax or cap and trade. And how do we ensure that our industry remains competitive, that our small businesses remain competitive? So it was really working with my stakeholders, large final emitters for the most part, in making sure that they can, that they're ready and they stay in Canada. And you know, that fed in really well, and plus the energy experience, the big black box that is, you know, that nobody understands in terms of electricity pricing. So that really fed in well into the Bitcoin mining space. So I think that's me. Oh, wait, I'm missing a big one. I also, the big Canadian bad news story was Quadriga. At the time, I called it the Tiger King of crypto story because it was very timely in that respect. But it really was the worst case scenario of what could happen at an exchange. And so I was appointed by the Supreme Court in Canada to be an official bankruptcy inspector. So I oversee the bankruptcy and EY, which is the trustee. And it's been interesting. It's been sad too, from the perspective of you get to hear stories, whether they were startups or businesses or just individuals who lost a lot of money. And it really goes to show, you know, holding your own Bitcoin is important because things still happen, right? Like people lose custody, people get scammed. It just continues to happen. It's a little, you know, less frequent, but when it does, you're not even going to get your money back right away, if at all, right? Look at Mt. Gox, still haven't received their funds, and Quadriga is taking a long time. Hopefully we're nearing the end of it. But anyway, so those are a lot of things I covered. So maybe I'll stop off there.
You have a hell of a resume. And I just want, since you have, you know, significant experience, at least with ETFs, more so than many other people we talk to, what are your thoughts with the fact that the United States is still kind of balking at approving a spot ETF over there? This is really big news. And once it gets approved, it's going to be fantastic. But until then, they're kind of dragging their feet. I want to hear your thoughts about this topic.
I'm surprised at how long it's taking. You know, the U.S. has been fairly competitive as a nation historically on tech and innovation. And I actually really expected it to happen last year. Gary seems really hell-bent on preventing that. And, you know, Canada, we fought it in court, right? 3IQ took the Ontario Securities Commission, which is, so in Canada, it's a little different. It's not the SEC, it's provincial regulators and securities administrators. But Ontario is kind of the one that the rest of the country looks towards for guidance, and they also kind of throw their weight around. So 3IQ went to court with them, and it was a 3-year battle to, you know, show that it really is in the public's best interest. So because there was a 26-page ruling from the judge, from the commissioner that made the decision around why it's in the public interest to have a retail Bitcoin fund, it really paved the way for all the funds that came in after and the ETFs. And so because we have this ruling, we now have a fund and funds, and the US doesn't have that kind of precedent, right? They have the Howey test so far.
So it took 26 pages to write number go up. That's incredible.
Yeah. Like this is the thing I don't understand, right? Like 26 pages in a suit is not really what it should take. And I know that probably their system is much more complex if you're trying to get over that hurdle. And, you know, when Gensler came into his role as SEC chair, I think there was a lot of hope, obviously in retrospect, misplaced in whether or not he would approve because he, you know, said Bitcoin in front of a bunch of kids once or something. And, you know, at MIT, okay, Megs, I guess the question I have for you then, and you know, this is maybe in the territory that you talk about, but what is the what in your view is the reason that they haven't approved it? And is it actually related to this, you know, investor protection mandate that he thinks he has? Because to me, this is sort of a moot point as all these other countries roll out, you know, multitudes of different Bitcoin and related ETFs, right? We just saw, for example, Leah Wald and Valkyrie launched the Bitcoin mining ETF, which is arguably like a 3x levered play on Bitcoin, which is also a 3x levered on some other, you know, on the queues or something, right? So what is it really investor protection? If it's not, what do you think it is?
It probably comes down to control and retaining some level of control. And I'm not privy to those kind of decisions, but I do understand, you know, the Biden administration has some concerns around Bitcoin right now. And there was talk about an executive order, and Gary is close to the administration. So there could be, there's likely some things that, you know, aren't obvious or public. And so there's that, but I think it honestly is a little silly, because it's clearly not an investor protection. Because if you look at the ETF that has been made public, the futures one, you know, I'm hearing that you lose about 15% between the carrying fees from year to year. So that's not obviously in a public interest. And there are a number of other vehicles that people are buying, whether that's MicroStrategy, you know, that hold exposure to Bitcoin, that kind of behave ETF-like, as well as the miners. So there's and then, you know, there's other funds that kind of hold a basket of these. And so we have ETF-like products. It really comes down to maybe it's that signal that now this is okay. The industry has come, and it is very disappointing not to have seen that, particularly as someone that used to work in public policy. We would very heavily look at other jurisdictions, especially if there is a precedent in something that's newer, whether it's technology or a type of regulation. And so the fact that, you know, the US, sorry, that Canada, that Europe, that some parts of Asia have spot ETFs is already to me a little odd, because again, you know, there is legal precedent. Canada were quite a similar country to the US. So there's, to me, again, it should be passed. And then even look at Grayscale, right? So folks are losing out on that too. The last I heard, it was trading, I think, negative 40%.
Oh yeah, it's high. Yeah.
It's quite, yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. I want to transition to another topic that when I heard we were getting you into the show, this is something I really wanted to discuss to you. And it's
when you Bitcoin. Heard you booked her. What do you mean when you heard?
No, well, when she...
I was like, do you guys not know I'm Canadian?
We're very thankful you reached out. But Bitcoin mining and the energy that it uses and the FUD surrounding this, there's so much talk around this about this. You have some very prominent people in power in the United States. I don't want to name names, but they keep drumming the same, same drums about it, you know, how much energy it uses, and it's bad for the environment. And there's always talk about proof of stake being perhaps the better of the two alternatives versus proof of work. I'm going to give you the floor here. Go nuts. I want to hear what your thoughts are about all this, because we've talked about it to death, Joy and I, but I want to hear somebody who has actually had some skin in the game with energy usage. So I want to hear your thoughts about what you think about Bitcoin mining, the energy it uses, and why it may be good. I'm not trying to lead you to that that conclusion, but here you go. The floor is yours.
There's just so many different points to cover. For me, I'll take it back. So as someone who observed the transition to a low carbon economy and sort of the regulatory pieces that were put in place, so I started working for the Ministry of Environment, actually helping put in cap and trade in 2009. Yeah. So a while ago. And, you know, at that time, every now and then the UNFCCC puts out sort of the, you know, new global agreements around carbon, right? And then different countries, similar to FATF and putting in FinTrack, you know, different laws like FinTrack issues, you know, follows the recommendations typically. There are targets that are set globally, and then each country is responsible for reducing those emissions. And energy is super tied into global emissions, right? Mm-hmm. For the most part, it's energy use and the type of energy that leads to emissions. So what I saw, you know, working in government is they kept moving the goalposts around when we're supposed to meet certain targets and what the targets were. So we had one of the big first known agreements was the Kyoto agreement, and that set certain reductions. And then we just kept shifting. Most recently, it's the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and now country. And so I remember, you know, we were targeting kind of 2030, 2040. And now countries are targeting net zero for 2050, 2060. So those goalposts move. And that's frustrating, partly because, you know, typically governments, they want to get voted back in. So they don't do anything stringent. Now they say, we will, you know, we're going to go for the next 10 years and then really ratchet it up. By 2030, we're going to, you know, super ratchet it up. It's going to get expensive. But for now, we'll let businesses, you know, stay competitive and take it easy. Well, you know, there's so historically there's been kind of like a policy failure. And also the other policy failure is an underinvestment in low carbon technologies that would lead to sort of these outcomes that they're trying to get. Because that kind of expenditure, you need either companies or government fronting it. So either private sector or public sector. And what I think is really fascinating about mining is, so we've seen policy not work very well in terms of failing to hit the targets. Governments don't want to put in the stringent reductions that they'd actually need if they want to get to those targets. Meanwhile, you have this sector that is completely based on economic incentives, as in miners mine because they're incentivized to do so. And what they're trying to do is find the cheapest sources of energy. And it, you know, often more and more it's becoming renewables based power, because if you look at, you know, costs and operating cost, that if you do a capital investment into infrastructure that is a renewable source, you know, you're taking air, water, like wind, water, sun, you don't have a consistent operating cost like when you're buying fuel and burning it. So in terms of your operations, it's beneficial because you don't have a constant cost outlay. And so what these miners are doing is they're partnering or co-locating with renewables sites, because the way that these renewable facilities work is they look at the lifetime of a project and they predict sort of what are revenues coming in, because we're going to be selling power at a certain point. And anytime you can add certainty to a project by saying, hey, there's going to be a customer that is buying at 2 cents for the next 20 years or 10 years or 5 years, there is some certainty around, you know, our projections. So we're going to go ahead with the project. So, you know, it's a benefit to renewables types of facilities because they can better plan their projects and the projects might go ahead. And it's awesome for miners because, for example, in Texas, where we were looking at locating, if your power is, you know, typically if you're buying off grid, it's like between 4 and 5 cents US. But if you can co-locate and get an agreement that's like 2 cents or 3 cents, you're winning, right? Because you're one of the most competitive miners out there. So it's an incentive to use a non-carbon source to partner with, you know, this renewable energy site. And that's what I think is really cool, is because that's just happening on its own. And there's other business models that I think are fascinating too. Canadian ones. So for example, Mint Green, what they're doing is they've partnered with the city of Vancouver. And they are going to be selling heat. So they are taking the power, which is primarily renewable because BC uses a lot of hydro. In Ontario, it's 50% base load is nuclear, but BC is primarily hydro. And so they're taking a renewable power source. They're displacing home heating traditionally, which is natural gas based, so fossil. And they're going to be selling the heat to the city of Vancouver. So they're winning because they're reducing their cost, because, you know, it's an additional revenue stream, or it's lowering their cost of power. The city is benefiting because it's actually reducing its reductions, because typically they would be burning fossil fuels. So it's another scenario where it's kind of an incentive for the miners to use that kind of business model that has a positive environmental outcome. And there's no policy that was specific that said, hey, miners, you should do this. It was incentives driven. Another really cool, there's actually a few other cool things. So flare gas in the oil and gas sector, whether in Canada, and there's a cool company in Alberta, Upstream Data from Steve. I love featuring Canadian companies. What they're doing is they're working with oil and gas providers who typically, as they produce oil, there's natural gas that is part of the deposit. So it's typically, you know, flared, because if you were to just let it leak out, it's CH4, which is methane, which is a much more potent greenhouse gas. So they burn it into, convert it to CO2, less potent greenhouse gas. So again, you know, miners are providing an environmental service, as in a more efficient process that converts methane to CO2. They're mining, you know, so there's a benefit there in terms of a revenue stream, and helping, you know, from the climate perspective. So again, it's another really cool model. Other places, for example, if you have a hog farm or a landfill gas, methane is naturally produced through the process, you know, the biological process. Mm-hmm. Same thing, same problem. You know, it's leaking to the atmosphere. Landfills or hog farms can capture that methane. And then again, if they burn it, it's biomass. So, you know, creating a fuel source that's biogenic. So it's not, you know, carbon-based emissions. And, you know, you're benefiting again, because it's probably a low cost resource, other than the infrastructure that's put in. But in some cases, you actually need to put in the infrastructure. For example, a lot of jurisdictions are putting in landfill gas capture as a necessity. So it's a way to reduce the cost of that infrastructure, because you might earn a revenue off of it if you're burning it. So I think there's some really cool stories there where miners are actually benefiting. And another thing that kind of came out recently, maybe not recently, but it's really hitting the scenes hard this week, is the whole, miners only, their lifetime or something like 1.5 years.
6 weeks, yeah.
I mean, below me, they're in my basement. There's an S9 that's still running. You know, sometimes my mom complains that the basement's a little bit hot, but especially in the winter, it's kind of great. And, you know, the S9, not S19. The S9, is, you know, they were launched in 2016. So they're still going. And it's frustrating to hear, you know, that there's this huge waste when there's a lot of recycling happening. And another really cool company that I want to highlight is PRTI. It's more from a waste management perspective. I want to highlight them. They're actually using waste tires. There's about 1 billion tires thrown out in the U.S. A year, including like new tires that just didn't meet the specs. So they're just, you know, in a landfill. Sometimes landfills catch fire. And what they're doing is they're actually taking the tire and they're using a thermal process to convert it into energy. So there's a synthetic gas, a synthetic oil that could be sold or burned to mine Bitcoin. And that's what they're doing, as well as byproducts that are valuable, like steel that can be recycled that's in the tire, and black carbon, which is typically produced in a chemical process. And so, you know, that's displacing the production of those kind of products that would normally, you know, have some CO2 emissions involved in that process, but you're actually reducing waste. So while it's not, you know, recycling electronic waste, it's still helping from an environmental positive perspective. So I think, and again, there's an economic benefit, because if you're typically, if you're throwing out waste or tires, you pay a tipping fee, you know, by the ton, you pay money to dispose. So sometimes, like, you can get paid to take in garbage and use it as energy. So I think, you know, these are really interesting business models that have positive environmental outcomes. And I think it's really hard to kind of, once you dive in and see that this is actually like fact versus opinion, like, oh, this is bad for the environment, versus the fact of this is happening and this is the environmental benefits that are accruing. Yeah, people like sound bites that make it sound awful, but it's very frustrating, especially Warren, right? Like, she's supposed to be, you know, fighting for the little guy, but it seems like, you know, the little guys are losing.
She's one of Len's favorite politicians. Megs, I gotta tell you, on this show, we always encourage the guests to like roll downhill, as we like to say. And so I think you were rolling downhill there pretty good. Like, we might have to put like a pile of tires at the bottom of that hill to stop you, I'm pretty sure, actually. So it's a couple of things I want to touch on there that you mentioned that I thought are interesting points. This idea that the incentives are what should drive Bitcoin mining. I agree with you that this is the case. But on this show, I've been pretty vocal, and we've had on other people who are pretty vocal about just completely disregarding anything ESG related. We had Marty Bent on. We've talked to Ben Gagnon from Bitfarms, you know, among others, who when you say stuff like renewables should be part of the mix, the answer generally is no, they shouldn't, unless it's you know, the last possible thing. Okay, so these are good sound bites if you like that opinion. And so I'm wondering if you have something you would say to those people about you know, why it is important to sometimes use the ESG framing as a positive for miners.
I disagree with Steve. I mean, I love what Steve does, but sometimes like he and I diverge. I mean, I did dedicate about a decade towards low carbon transition and also in low carbon transition of the energy grid. So I think what it comes down to for me is to have a resilient grid, you need a variety of sources. So you need your nuclear as baseload, but I think you also need your hydro, wind, solar. They play in at different times of the day. And I get where Steve's coming from in terms of life cycle impacts versus impacts at the source, just emitting right there versus emissions as for the materials that were produced into into the turbines. I think that's typically where he's coming from. And I do, understand that point. But I think from moving that aside from the perspective of having a diversified grid, I think that's kind of the best option that we want to aim towards is having diverse sources. I mean, we're not at the point yet where we can do something like black matter, dark matter, which is like apparently the best energy source out there. But I do think, we want a diversity.
But Bitcoin miners typically they tend to flock towards the cheapest and most stable types of energy, whatever it may be, regardless of the source. It doesn't really care. But one of the things that I find to be like really encouraging is there, and you touched upon it too, when you're using the gas that's typically flared, but in that case, they're diverting it towards a generator to create energy to mine Bitcoin. So in those regards, I love how Bitcoin miners could solve problems that exist right now. And in those cases too, that's stranded energy that probably would never be used anyway. So I think this is something we should be bringing to the forefront to when we're talking to the people that are prominently in power or prominent and talking about how Bitcoin mining is terrible for the environment, uses too much energy. Those are the people we have to basically tell them, look, Bitcoin mining, it's not here to take the energy that you're using right now. It's using the energy that is not being used right now. And furthermore too, another thing that people don't really talk about is it's the buyer of last resort. Bitcoin is not taking energy that you're using. It's the energy that you're not using too on the grid. So theoretically in Quebec, for instance, when things get really hairy over there and they have to power more homes divert more power to homes to heat their homes when it's very cold, they throttle back power towards Bitcoin miners. And this is something that, it seems to be lost on a lot of these people. And somehow we have to address this. I don't know what is the best way, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think what's also interesting about Canada is we have population centers that kind of are near the border. We have Toronto, which is probably the largest population center, but you also have people that live up north. And primarily, there's a lot of First Nations communities up north that are not grid connected. So they're not transmission distribution connected. And what the government is currently doing is they're actually paying money to send diesel trucks up there for diesel generators, which are, both from a carbon but air emission impact, they're terrible. And so, us as taxpayers, we're paying to do this. So what I think would be really neat is having Bitcoin miners kind of, as I was saying, when you're predicting a cost of an energy project, there are certain revenues that you're coming in and there's certain costs. What's happening in the US is there's some pilot projects, like I think it was Okla that's partnering with Compass, for example, and they're building smaller scale nuclear reactors in a certain community. And the mining, could provide a revenue stream until that town kind of scales up, whether it's businesses or residential individuals. So something like setting up a First Nations community where you can reduce the cost of power, whether you're setting up some sort of renewable site, maybe it's a biomass plant, because if you look at Atikokan in Ontario, it was phased out, coal plant was phased out, but it was then converted into a biomass plant, right? And there's a lot of biomass in Canada. We have a lot of forests. So if we then, help reduce the cost of the infrastructure through a predictable revenue stream like mining, it maybe makes the project more feasible. And so when I looked at GHG reducing technologies, you know, that could be adopted by our industries in Canada back then, a lot of it came down to cost. And then, you know, does government need to subsidize it? Well, guess what? We don't need a government to subsidize this project anymore because we have Bitcoin that could help subsidize this energy project that would then power this small community. So I think it'd be interesting to start looking at different kind of revenue models or different models to do public policy. Typically we looked at, it was like the triple P. It was public, private, and, oh my God, I'm missing a third one. Public, private. Anyways, it was the government plus the private sector, right? Oh, institutions like academia. Right. But now you almost like you add Bitcoin miners to the mix because you have a new pocket.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. And I know Len usually asks this question, but cut him off at the knees here. So, you know, Megs, you're making the case for why energy and Bitcoin mining are really synergistic in a way that, you know, people outside the space have yet to realize. And some politicians, you mentioned your friend Liz, both of you guys are very close with her. She's at your Thanksgiving dinners, et cetera. So, you know, when you talk about these things, you must think that there's at least some potential for energy producers to start mining Bitcoin themselves. Cut out the middleman. We don't need to sell this other energy to miners. We'll take care of this ourselves. Are they going to do that? Why or why not? And why are they not doing it already?
Well, I've actually spoken to two global names that are both in the oil and gas industry and renewable energy industry. They've been looking at it for a while and they are continuing to look at it. It hasn't been announced yet. Can't say anything about that. But think of these large companies, like Fortune 500 type of companies that, you know, billions of dollars of revenue type of thing. They are institutions on their own. They're kind of like a government and they take a long time to make decisions and they have to, you know, fully think it through. So, you know, just because they haven't done it yet doesn't mean they're not contemplating, and they likely are, right? And, you know, we just had the announcement about ConocoPhillips doing a pilot. My understanding is they're not mining themselves, but they are partnering with a miner for the gas. But that's the first large scale miner that's been made public that's doing that. And at some point, the next step is a pilot project where they are mining themselves. So first, they want to kind of get familiar with it, right? And then they'll do another pilot project. And then eventually they'll mine themselves, or, you know, maybe they'll do a partnership, like a joint venture. So there's different ways to kind of skin the cat. And so I do fully expect both oil and gas large companies and renewable global asset managers to be, you know, announcements should be coming.
You have S9 in your basement, so you know what's required to mine. You know the incentive to mine. You know how much cost to energy you need to actually turn a profit when you're mining. So
it's not great right now. I will say that.
And S9 isn't the most efficient miner, but still, it's not profitable.
I think the cost of, because I'm in Ontario, I'm mining in Ontario. I think the cost of power is, we're kind of breaking even at these prices, I think, and considering what Ontario power is. But that said, I kind of look at it as like, yeah, that's the current price of Bitcoin, but it'll be 5 or 10x from now. So even it's if I'm like, up. Let's say I'm losing 20%, you know, it's still, I'm still ahead from a certain perspective. But if you're mining somewhere else where it's cheaper, then for sure it's easy. I think it's really changed since a year ago where, you know, the network was cut in half. We're back to kind of where we were. So I remember I was, how much was I making? It was like, let's say $10 a day, which again, it's not a lot of money when it comes down to it, right? It's not a lot of Bitcoin, but like, you know, hey, $10 a day at the time is what we were getting. Right now I'm getting anywhere between, sorry, that was the US. I think I'm getting like two and a half to like four a day. So it's not great, but you know, it's like, hey, I'm still mining.
This could be scaled easily though. Just multiply the amount of miners.
Yes, you can. Well, so
wouldn't this be like the big equalizer then for countries out there that are just developing nations that have excess power to just somehow, easier said than done, but to just put in a whole bunch of miners on their grid, mine 100%. Away, and it's going to make them, elevate them in the global scale, because it, you know, you could pick a country, I don't want to name one, but they're stuck in where they are. They're kind of just treading water or spinning their wheels. This is the great equalizer. And this is going to revolutionize a lot of countries on how they do business. This is so bullish for me. I can't wait to see what
we're going to throw some cold water on you here after that.
I'm going nuts. I can't wait to hear this. But yeah, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Like about maybe a country adopting, or not adopting Bitcoin, but looking into mining it.
So home mining is very different. Like you get economies of scale as you get bigger, right? You build a large facility, your costs go down the more miners you have, just because you're depreciating that cost over like a wider base of miners. So like the facility cost, right? And there, you know, the amount of staff, you get some efficiencies of scale there too. So I do think it's an interesting proposition as a country that, and again, I think it depends on kind of how the energy sector is structured. Is it state owned? Like in Canada, for example, it's energy is provincial. So, you know, BC Hydro has their own generation, Ontario Hydro has its own generation. In the US, you know, sometimes there's mixed models. Like sometimes it's owned by the state, like some resources are owned by the state in New York, for example, and then they have like special economic development programs where they provide energy predictability to attract businesses there. But then there's also private generators. So it really kind of depends. So if you have a state, unlike Canada, you know, or a nation that has its own power generation, I think it's a much easier kind of way to go about and mine it. And you know, maybe it's a better story than just, hey, we bought Bitcoin and we put it on our balance sheet. Is just like, you know, we're mining and we're stacking because we have these natural resources that historically we leveraged in a different way. But now we're actually leveraging, you know, our energy resources in this manner. So I do think it's an attractive, you know, proposition for a country to start mining. I'm not, so El Salvador, right? They're proudly announcing it. Russia is, I'm unclear. Have they, like, are they actually officially mining or is it just, so I don't know what's going on there, but I think
they're not officially anything, but you know, if I had to guess one way, another, I would say they probably are or are very close.
Yeah. And that's, there's a difference between I'm a government worker who is mining versus like the nation state and it's going into their treasury, right? So we haven't had that yet, but it's quite possible we could see it in the, you know, United Arab Emirates, for example, where they have big oil. They might at some point decide to go that route. And it's interesting too, looking at, you know, that region, they have been diversifying at not just in oil, but in also renewables, because they see kind of long term where the world's going. So it wouldn't necessarily just be using their oil and gas resources.
So, okay, all these things that you've said to us so far have been outstanding. You're really a wealth of knowledge. Okay, it's been a pleasure. But I gotta ask. Okay, so you're a recovering policy contributor for the province. You from there, you know, joined up with different, I think you were a partner in or helped with Validus Power at some point.
I'm more talked to Greg, but yeah.
Okay, so you got that under your belt. You've done, you know, a multitude of other things. And now, if I look at your resume here, there's a couple lines that stick out closer to current day. Okay, one of them is this coin. How did you get in with CoinKite? Because all the things you just said, you know, as much as I enjoyed them, none of them are about hardware wallets. None of them are about any of that stuff. So how did you end up catching up with those guys?
Rodolfo's very persuasive. it was interesting, but it's not, to be fair, it's not completely out of scope of work. So I, like I said, I'm actually a creditor of Quadriga, right? So I lost money, and fundamentally being part of that process and the bankruptcy, you know, you really see the effects of the negative effects on regular people when they lose their money, and you feel it yourself. But then you hear, you know, about these businesses, they're like, well, I was just about to pay myself as like a small business, and we were going to use this as runway, and now we have to shut down, right? So you hear those stories and you're like, okay, custody is really important. Making sure that people custody properly is very important. And even just like following on Twitter, like I know we're very Bitcoin, but I keep seeing all these 48 Yacht Club people losing their apes. Like just, it's just so ridiculous. And I'm thinking there's a better way, right? Like, and you know, let's say they had, they're using like a Ledger or a Trezor and they give up their seed. Your Bitcoin's gone too. It's not just your NFTs, right? So I think fundamentally, like, if you are trading, you're doing DeFi, you're doing NFTs, like, keep your Bitcoin separate. Keep it on a cold card, Bitcoin only wallet, reduce your attack vectors, don't connect it, you know, because they're constantly, you know, hooking up their wallets to the internet and, like, you know, signing transactions, right? Because that's how you do it with smart, you know, they're interacting with smart contracts. So the whole point is, like, you know, some, there's Bitcoiners that, you know, should only invest in Bitcoin, but I take the idea that, like, it's really hard to convince others, you know, invest in this versus that. There's the trial by fire technique, which is, hey, if you invested in ICOs, you're like, oh shit, I lost all my money. So that's trial by fire. Yeah, I did that too. So that was my learning moment. But the point is, like, people are adults. If they want to do that and then they lose their money, they'll learn, right? And, you know, if they leave their money on an exchange like Quadriga, that's another trial by fire moment. And you really learn, you know, what's important. And custody is very important in how you store it, and whether it's with a third party and whether you're willing to undertake certain kinds of risks. You know, some people are doing things like Bitcoin backed loans, and that itself, it's like pretty cool opportunity, especially, you know, the Bitcoin mortgage. So some people are willing to undertake that risk, you know, because, hey, finally I can buy a house because the bank doesn't recognize all this Bitcoin. But you know, so Quadriga kind of put the importance of custody in. And I think too, I seem to be traversing in this Bitcoin space where I'm very physically connected versus, like, we're not making code, like, we're making physical hardware products. Mining is this interesting interface, you know, where you're straddling both the physical and the digital world. So I think wallets are kind of that too. And lastly, like, wallets are kind of like the base layer in a way. Like, it all comes down to, like, everybody will need a wallet of some sort, whether you're choosing to have a physical hardware wallet, whether it's a browser, mobile phone app, like, you have to have a wallet somehow. And I think what CoinKite is doing is really cool, and that we're empowering people to, you know, take custody themselves. And we have some cool products coming down the pipe that are NFC enabled. So whether that's our Mark IV cold card that you can sign, you know, if you have a mobile wallet, maybe you're doing an on-chain to Lightning transaction, right, to populate a channel. And we also have the Tap Signer, which is which can include a little bit more for the developing world. It'll have a cheaper price, but it's the same thing. You know, people are using their mobiles so much more these days. Like, I sometimes pick it over my laptop too, right? So I think we're going to find ways to interact and sign using mobile, and why not use, you know, a cold card if you're doing that.
What's the biggest challenge for having somebody buy a cold card, for instance? Because if you look at people that are new to Bitcoin, the one thing that they kind of have a hard time grasping is the keys and the wallet itself. What would you say would be, what would you tell them as a way to ease their concerns about the, you know, how hard it is to actually hold your own keys and have your own wallet? Yeah. Because cold card is fantastic. And the Mark IV one that's coming out, and it's $40 off, I believe, for anybody that's looking for pre-ordering. I've been pumping that up to a few of my friends. like, give us like a lowdown. Like,
you guys should get an affiliate code if you don't have one yet.
Listen, don't give many ideas.
No, but tell us, like, what are the benefits? How easy is it to use? Like, just pump your bags here. Like, let's
get people on the cold card. Well, it's funny because, like, when I first started, you know, I didn't know better. So I use a Ledger, right? Because again, I got into the time when I was into alts and, you know, mistakes were made. But so that was my first experience, was a Ledger, right? And I remember, you know, going through the process, but actually going through the setup of the cold card, it's pretty easy too. And it actually provides you with more information that you can follow along. I think the challenge that people have, there's also like a lot of miscommunication. So our competitors are like, well, we can't compete with them on features and quality and products, but we can say that they're more challenging to use. So that's kind of their, you know, in. Or, you know, some of them, like, if someone's looking to hold altcoins, they'll probably buy something else because we don't support altcoins, right? But again, as I say, keep them separate. Get two wallets at least. Okay, so that said, the challenging part, I think, comes in is, you know, something like Ledger or Trezor, they create this whole interface that maybe makes it a little bit simpler. And I think people are used to like, well, I expect everything by, you know, to be made simple for me. But with the cold card, you know, there's a number of third parties that that we are compatible with. And to some degree, you know, like if let's say Blue Wallet just speaks to you better for some reason, because maybe it is a little bit, it's mobile, and you want to use a cold card, go for it. You know, some people choose Sparrow, some people choose Electrum, depending on what their setup is, right? So so there's choice. In some ways, choice is great. But in other ways, choice is, you know, analysis paralysis. So I think that's what it comes down to. But honestly, like, we recently released a very simple, like, set it up like you're a total beginner, use the cord, because you can learn down the road how to do an air gap. But if you're not ready for that, you can sign, like, just like a Ledger, just like a Trezor, you know, and we have buttons as opposed to the little side buttons. So you can start that way and sort of, you know, improve along. Like, you don't ride a motorcycle, right? Maybe you ride a bike first and then you ride, you don't ride like a 1500 horsepower either from the get go. So, you know, you got to walk, then you can run, right?
So, okay. This is the cold card stuff is great. And I'm guilty of not owning one, but maybe I should take a dive into that realm, right?
It's $40 off the Ford of Mach 4.
I
know.
Yeah, you might as well get the NFC, because I think that will make it a lot easier too. Cause the whole point of our product is the only wallet out there that has an air gap, like air, as in there is air. Cause some people don't even understand that, right? It's not connected to the internet, guys. It's an air gap. So, you know, there's a SD card that you sign your transaction and, you know, you upload and broadcast it to the network. And so that can, to some people, it just sounds very challenging, or if they're not comfortable, but, you know, something like Tap is a lot simpler, right? So, sign up for that. And I do want to add, some people are, you know, maybe they're not NFT fans. Maybe they're like, oh, I don't know, maybe it opens me to some obscure vulnerability. Guess what? You can just get rid of the NFC. You can disable it. So
I did read that. You guys can actually, like, you just take the thing off, right? That's pretty cool.
Yeah. There's a lot of optionality.
I do like that feature. I think before I go for a cold card, Megs, maybe I will, but, you know, the thing I would really rather buy from you is a block lock.
Oh, and God, this, I love the block
this
clock.
This is like the Bitcoin podcast. Like, I got to get rid of all this sort of nonsense my wife likes, and just put a block clock there and not tell her, right? And just see what happens. Maybe she'll like it. Tell her it's Russian time, et cetera, et cetera. what is the origin of that product? Because that is a kick ass product.
Yeah,
that no one else was able to come up with for so many years. No one else had that idea, and now everyone wants one. It's incredible.
Yeah. So the, how the a block, the concept of a block cut came along was, so we had a different block clock, before. It was a very premium, model. I think it was like 5 or 6,000 US. And it was like, you know, custom made, and, you know, those little digits that the numbers change, like in the train stations. Yeah, I don't remember what they're called, but they're only like available one place in Poland. I'm actually Polish, so I laughed at this. And so, you know, it was an expensive product, but a lot of people loved it. So for Bitcoin's 10-year anniversary, CoinKite decided to make a more affordable model. And I know 400 US is pricey, but honestly, it's super good quality. And it's made in Canada, guys. But it's pretty awesome. Like, you can display so much info. And I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, just all the info you can display on it. Obviously, you know, Bitcoin pricing, you can make custom, you can push custom things, but you also have things like just mining stats, right? And, you know, we're open to working on new feeds, but obviously right now there's like some other priorities, like getting TapSigner and all the other products going, but like it looks nice. Like, it really looks high quality, right? And I think the best part was like when Jack put it in the background.
That's an all-time Bitcoin moment. And you got these blue checks working themselves up into a lather about whether it's time in Russia. Like, get fucked. I know, you guys are nuts, man.
The publicity was fantastic, but the comments of what it really is or what they thought it is just amazing. It's just
I saw a lot of like crypto clock.
Nobody has a clue.
I love it.
Yeah, there's one question I have, and I see this on your, well, I saw it before on your website. I think it's called an Uncle Jim. and it's
a bundle. Yeah, it comes.
What is that? I mean, I'm curious a little bit more about that.
I love that. That's another another good product name from you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it comes down to like it's a bundle, like if you want to be, you know, self-sovereign, but I believe Uncle Jim the origins come down to amongst the privacy space. I'm less familiar with it, but maybe when Rodolfo comes in, or maybe someone in the audience has the exact.
Okay, I know where the Uncle Jim came from. I think the Uncle Jim came from, the first time I heard it was from Marty and Matt on the whole recap, talking about how you can be the Bitcoin Uncle Jim at Thanksgiving if you have all this stuff. You can be like the coach for someone who wants to jump on.
Okay. I'm new here, for the record. I've been here since November, so I'm not up to speed on all the origin story.
In the world of Bitcoin, that's a long time.
As an attorney,
let's be honest.
All the gray hair.
we got two more questions. One, actually, they're both fun. The last one will give you a bit of a ruffle in your personal life. But you know, I've followed you on Twitter for some time, Megs, and I know that you are very passionate about something you do, not Bitcoin related. You are, I believe, a volunteer firefighter.
I am.
Talk to me about that. What is the story behind that? How did you decide you wanted to do that? What's that all about?
Peer pressure. So when I moved to British Columbia, my partner moved first, and he joined the local fire department because it's kind of like the pillar of the community, right? Like, you know, we hold all sorts of events through the year. We have like an Easter egg hunt. We, Canada Day, people can come in, look at the trucks, like we spray kids with water kind of thing, fireworks around Halloween, New Year's, there's the dip in the ocean. So we're always there on site to help people in case they get frostbite, because it's really cool. So you know, part of it was like, you know, when you move and you're an adult, it's really hard to make friends. So, you know, it's a way to meet people. It's a way to give back to the community. So he would be going, you know, to the fire department, and then he would have call outs. So a call out is when a call comes in, either medical. So we assist with them. We cut you out of the car. We use the jaws of life. We're trained in the jaws of life, which is pretty cool. we will, you know, bandage you up and then put you towards the paramedics. We'll put out your car. We'll put out your house fire. Yes, we'll rescue your cat if needed. We really do it all. Like, we get such a diversity of calls, whether it's divers, because there's a dive site nearby, you know, in distress. We help with the landing sites. If there's, you know, the landing zone for helicopters, if you need to get medevaced out, we shut down the highway sometimes, which is really cool when they land on the highway. Basically, we're there on your worst day, and we try to help as best we can, right? And so, you know, my partner ended up having all these friends who are firefighters, and they're all like, when are you joining? Like, as soon as you move. And I was kind of like, yeah, this sounds pretty cool. And honestly, I love it. I mean, obviously it's not always great. Like, it can be challenging and difficult emotionally, especially if there's like a fire in your community, because people are close knit, but it's I love doing it. Like, you go out and you play with big toys.
That's a pretty solid case for joining a volunteer firefighter. I know.
And I, you know, here's the thing. A lot of Bitcoiners are actually, I think, moving to kind of smaller towns. Well, in North America, it's either 70 or 80% of all fire departments are volunteer. Like, the majority are unpaid. Some of them are paid. You can have paid volunteers. So you're only like, let's say you go in for 2 hours for a call or for training, you can get paid. And that's a personal choice of the department. But the majority are volunteer. And not as in not career, like you're not there all day waiting for the call. And so, and it's something I think I would encourage you to, because not only like if you do first responder, because I'm a first responder and a firefighter. So you get taught first responder skills, right? Like, you're right below paramedic, but you get taught a lot of, and that's good. Like, if you have a family, if you've got friends and you're out somewhere and there's some sort of medical emergency, like, these valuable skills. Imagine now having two firefighters in that family. That's even better, right? Especially if you're like, something happens to the kid. And just like, it's a way, you know, to feel closer to in a community. So I kind of encourage anyone who's out there in a small town, like, look into it. It's a cool thing to be part of.
I like that. Okay, so our last question for you, Meg, so you got to give me a little bit of help here. So you're one of, I think we've had, I think, three women on the show. Then Meg's is our third or our second.
Number two, I think. I can't.
Number two. So
after Sue, is there another one? I don't know.
I don't remember. We had Sue Ennis from Hut. And now you. And so you mentioned you know the co-founders. So are you? You know Jamie, obviously.
But Jamie was not a founder or co-founder. Okay. Jamie came in much later.
So who are your? Give me your two favorite women in crypto that we should.
Canada.
Sure. Why not?
Well, in Canada. Okay, so I love Amber from Outlier. Okay. And I think it'd be also very pertinent to have her on. So she's like the expert. Actually, she's well regarded globally around AML, KYC, you know, financial, like terrorism. So if you're a crypto company, more than like in Canada, more than likely you would go to her because they are the experts. They only focus on Canada. So they're experts on, you know, creating compliant programs. And I think, you know, she'd be a cool person to interview because she's always like super fun and just generally, and given what's happening today, you know, like or this week around the FinTrack regs, it might be an interesting perspective that she could provide. So Amber, and then let me think, another lady. Is there a particular area that you need?
Doesn't matter to me. She doesn't know what I'm going to ask her right after. Elaine, she's like really building up her friends and she's about to find out why I'm asking. No particular space.
No, I'm just kind of curious. Like if you're looking for something specific.
No, not at all.
Oh, shoot. See, that's the problem. Like, so for the last like 2 years, I was like, forget Canada. We don't have anything exciting going on. Like I'm going to do global outreach and I get to know a lot of people, but I'll have to think about, I'm kind of like at a loss because I'm thinking of, you know, women, but they're not necessarily in
Canada.
Give me
an American. Give me an American.
Oh, an American. Okay. Ooh, there's a lot of ladies doing really cool things. What area do you want?
Listen, I'm not giving you any help here. I'm just looking for two names.
This is like, no, yeah, I know. Like there's obviously like women that I respect, whether it's Caitlin Long or like Lynn Alden, you know,
right.
Things that I always listen
Lynn,
to.
Let's go with Lynn. Okay. So let's say you and Amber and Lynn, okay, are in a parking lot. Y'all have on your favorite running shoes, shorts, t-shirts, whatever, okay? And 40 yards away, there's a finish line, checkered flag.
Okay.
Who's winning a 40-yard foot race between you, Amber, and Lynn Alden?
Can I switch it up? There's a fire.
Go ahead.
40 yards away. You got to put
there's a fire 40 yards away. Oh, okay. You got to get there, put it out. Who's winning that race and by how much?
Oh, okay. Well, if there's a fire, humans tend to have a fight or flight response. So I'd say I might have an advantage because I've actually been in a building, burning building. So I might have an advantage there. But if it's just a straight race, I feel like Lynn is a runner. Mm. I'm not a runner. I hate running, to be honest.
Okay, there you go. Okay, so Lynn, we got to get Lynn on the show to talk about this race. This is what we always do. We just add the foot race at the end, and then we tell people what the person said. Yeah, maybe you talk to him. Okay, Megs, you've been great. Tell people, you know, where they can find you, CoinKite, all that stuff. Floor is all yours.
Yep. So you can find me on Twitter at @crypto_Megs. And yes, I know there's probably Bitcoiners watching, but guess what? This is how we get those people that are dabbling in alts and we bring them into our ecosystem. They're like, oh, crypto. They're like, they're going to just get spammed with Bitcoin. So @crypto_Megs. And then, I don't really do LinkedIn anymore. And we're at CoinKite. It's interesting. So we have like each of our products has its own handle and has its own website. So it's all over, you know, whether it's a cold card wallet or CoinKite or BlockClock. Yeah.
You gotta check it out. Megs, awesome. Thank you for coming on. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for inviting me. Bye guys.
Bye.
Hey.